For those of you who have forgotten, we are in the midst of the study of Hebrews. And we've been talking about a concept. It is the concept of the third temple. Highly controversial. And you know, I got to tell you, in any time in history, there is no better time to be talking about this concept of the third temple, because it is the hottest topic in Israel. It is making headlines every single week. It is going around. There's a buzz all over the world about the Jewish people. They're getting ready to build the third temple. The momentum is building more and more every day. It's building, it's building, it's building. You're getting this momentum. You're seeing this. And they're focused. All the artifacts are created. They're breeding the heifers. They're practicing the altars, the sacrifices. They're running through everything. Everything's a go. Everything's ready. They're looking at this. And guess what? In the midst of this, in the midst of what we see with all of this, there are signs that are coming out in Yerushalayim. And one of the things that we talked about in our last message, just as a reminder, as we looked at some of these supernatural prophetic signs, you have snakes coming out of the prayer wall. You have massive stones that are set on top of somehow literally falling out. Hundreds of pounds, almost killing a woman at the prayer wall. These things are happening. I mean, this is so while the Jews are moving and they got everything going, they're gonna rebuild the temple, miraculous signs are taking place in Yerushalayim. Literally, within 1 week of me giving that message, another sign showed up. And this one is really incredible. And this sign stirred the rabbis. They took to the synagogues, they took to the web, commenting on it, talking about it, everyone's about it, rabbis writing about it, blogging, doing articles. What you just saw, if you could not see it, and the video is pretty raw, is foxes literally at the Temple Mount in Yerushalayim. Now, you might not think that's a big deal, but I'm going to tell you right now, this is end of the world prophecy stuff, life-altering prophecy. This stirred the rabbis into pandemonium when this happened. Foxes being seen, unprecedented. This is incredible. This is an incredible thing. I want to read to you how the rabbis are responding to this sign, how they're looking at it. This is very important. And I get this out of Breaking News Israel. The headline reads, "Foxes at the Temple Mount, prophetic proof, Yerushalayim returning to glory." This is how the rabbis are viewing this, that this specific sign, this is a clear sign, it portends, this is a good omen. Good things are right around the corner because we saw these foxes. I mean, it's crazy that they're seeing these foxes play. I want to read to you what this article says. And the gentleman who wrote this, Berkowitz, I respect him. He's a good man. I mean, I appreciate him. And he's an ordained rabbi. He really does a good job for Breaking News Israel. But he writes on this, and I want to read this to you. This is what he says. "It was reported in the yeshiva world that visitors to the area have observed the group of about a dozen foxes in the southwestern area of the Western Wall for the last 3 days in the early hours of the day. Wild foxes at the site of the destroyed temple are described." I'm going to say that again. "Wild foxes at the site of a destroyed temple are described specifically in the Jewish Talmud. This Talmud, which was written 2,000 years ago as a sign that Jerusalem will be rebuilt. This precise scenario was discussed in the Talmud, specifically Tractate Makot 24b. Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah, Rabbi Yehoshua, Joshua, and Rabbi Akiva went up to Yerushalayim." Now, here's the deal. You have these great men within the Jewish faith, men of renown. Rabban, that title means Gamliel was presiding over the Sanhedrin, one of the presidents of the Sanhedrin. And you have these great rabbis, and you know Rabbi Akiva, all right? Well, look at what happens. We read this. "When they reached the Temple Mount, they saw a fox emerging from the place of the Holy of Holies, The others started weeping, but Rabbi Akiva laughed. Now, you got to appreciate the situation. The temple is destroyed, okay, at this point. There's no temple. It's been destroyed. In the days of Rabbi Akiva, it's not there. And what they're doing is these great men within with Judaism, they go up. You got these three great men on the right side, if you will. They're looking at this sign. A fox is coming out of the Temple Mount. They see foxes. They're weeping. Rabbi Akiva is laughing. You could not have two different interpretations of the exact same sign. Now look at what goes on next. He goes on. Rabbi Akiva asked the rabbis why they cried. And they explained that to see a wild animal in such a holy place, a place which was forbidden to unfit men, was distressing. They saw it as a bad omen. This is not a good sign. It's an unclean animal traipsing over the Holy Temple Mount. This is not a good sign. Well, Rabbi Akiva goes on and he says this. Rabbi Akiva noted that this was precisely the reason he laughed. He explained that the fact that the prophecy of Uriah related to the prophet Micah had come to be was proof that the prophecy of Zechariah would also come to be. And in other words, basically, Rabbi Akiva is saying, he's saying, because one prophecy comes true, well, it stands to reason that another prophecy will come true. And therefore, this of what he's looking at, he is looking at this sign of a fox literally traipsing over the Holy Temple Mount. And so now he sees this as a good omen. And this is a time to laugh. Now, hear me closely. This is the Rabbi Akiva that proclaimed Bar Kokhba as the true Messiah. As the true Messiah, he deceived his own people. He himself was deceived. And what happened? The Jewish people were led to their slaughtered. Because they actually believed Bar Kokhba was the Messiah. This is that Rabbi Akiva. Now, I don't know about you. It terrifies me when I see rabbis and mass numbers going out, looking at this sign as though it portends good is right on the horizon, all because of Rabbi Akiva. They're looking at this through his eyes and they're understanding. Because Rabbi Akiva laughed, well, this is a time for rejoicing. We know, as the title read, that Jerusalem is just on the cusp of returning to its glory. This is how we view it. One thing I can tell you for certain. When you read the Bible and you listen to the prophets and you see what is happening in Yerushalayim right now and in Israel and the rest of the parts of the world, it is not a time for laughter. I guarantee it. It is not. It is a time to listen to the prophets. And what do the prophets say? They say this. Now, therefore, says the Lord, turn to me with all your heart, with fasting, with weeping, and with mourning. James says, let your laughter be turned to mourning, your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of your Lord. This is what we're called to do. Ecclesiastes, sorrow is better than laughter, because by a sad countenance, the heart is made better. He who sows tears will reap joy. Psalm 126, 5. Even Yeshua says in Luke chapter 6, you know what he says? Those who mourn now will laugh later. It is time to listen to the prophets. It terrifies me what I am seeing and how people are interpreting these signs. And this is nothing new. You know this. We have covered this. We've covered how we've looked at past historical events in Israel's history, and there are always rabbis that were looking at this and saying, oh, this portends a good thing. Good is coming our way, when it was the exact opposite. Even in the Bar Kokhba revolt, there were even Gentiles said their signs were all there, but they didn't understand them, that they were going to be led to their slaughter. This is an amazing thing. Listen to me carefully. When you go to Scripture, nowhere are you going to find foxes metaphorically representing or carrying any connotation whatsoever that is positive for Israel. Nowhere. And let me just give you a couple examples. Song of Songs. Catch us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. Now understand what it says. Our vines are, we're coming into bloom. Israel's coming into bloom. Get the foxes, they spoil the vine. Foxes represent destruction, desolation, calamity. This is what foxes represent scripturally. We need to listen to the prophets on this one. Ezekiel 13:3. Thus says the Lord God, woe to the foolish prophets who follow their own spirit and have seen nothing. O Israel, your prophets are like foxes in the desert. Foxes are attributed to false prophets, to deception, to destruction. Because what do false prophets do? They lead the people of God to their death. That's what they do, okay? Even Yeshua, he actually says in Luke 13, I believe it is, but he says, go tell Herod that fox that I cast out demons, I do great works. I'll do them tomorrow, and on third day, I'm gonna be glorified. He wasn't paying Herod a compliment. It's a derogatory term. It carries a very negative connotation. So understand something. When we see this end of the world sign happening, unprecedented, where foxes are coming in into Yerushalayim, you have a problem. Something, this is a real sign. Something is coming. And I'm gonna tell you what it is. Tribulation. Persecution is coming. All the signs are there that we are moving into the time of Jacob's trouble. This is where we're moving. Nobody wants to hear that. Nobody wants to acknowledge that reality. But God is sending signs. And Yeshua rebukes the hypocrites. You can discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times. Hypocrites. This scares me. And so when we look at these rabbis that are coming out, and they're getting excited about seeing foxes coming because of Rabbi Akiva, not because of the prophets, not because of Torah, but because of Rabbi Akiva, who led his own people to their death. That frightens me. This kind of deception should not be among God's chosen people, especially the leaders. It should not be. Not okay. With that said, I want to break into the topic we left off on. The abomination of desolation. The abomination of desolation. If we're going to talk about the third temple, and whether it's going to be celestial in nature, or whether it's earthly, whether it's to be built by man, as we see, they got everything they need. Is it going to be built by man, or is it to be built by the Mashiach? As the prophets clearly say, and even past rabbis have acknowledged, no, it's going to be absolutely celestial. Man isn't going to build it. It's going to come out of the sky. As Rashi said, and looking at Exodus 15 and saying the Torah shows it. It's completely celestial. Well, I'm going to tell you, when you start talking about stuff like this, you have to deal with questions. And one of the questions is what do you do with the abomination of desolation? Because clearly, I mean, many Christians, the way they look at the abomination of desolation, well, this is proof. There must be a literal, physical, functioning temple in Jerusalem for this to happen. This cannot happen unless that happens. We're going to dig into this day, and you might have a little different perspective after today's message. And you might understand just how close we are to the return of the Messiah, Yeshua. We are closer than people know. It is so close, it's scary. And so, with that said, I want to take you back to Matthew 24, and this is where we ended off in the last message. Yeshua went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And again, one of the things that I covered here is his disciples are elated. They're taking joy in her stones, exactly how Psalm 102 said to do. Her servants take pleasure in her stones. They delight in them. And they want to make their Messiah proud. They want to show Yeshua they have the right heart. And so they come up to him to show him all the beauty of the temple and to rejoice with him. It totally makes sense to me, especially when you know scripture. But how Yeshua responds is totally mind-blowing, not what you would expect if you were there in that time period. And Yeshua said to them, do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. The last thing, if you were his disciple, you would ever expect to hear, because you're looking at the Messiah. You know Yeshua is the Messiah. You are following him as the Messiah. There's no question. And the Messiah, everything that tells you in the scriptures is that he is the Redeemer. He will restore Israel. And now the Messiah himself is telling you, what? The temple, our very identity is going to be destroyed? That doesn't even make sense. But here's what blows my mind, is how they respond to this statement. They didn't even blink. We go on and we read, now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately and said, tell us when these things will be. They don't come back and say, Yeshua, you know, that sounds crazy. This is the exact opposite of what we're expecting. This doesn't make any sense. You know, like Peter did with Yeshua in Matthew 16, when Yeshua told him that he needed to die. He had to go to the cross, and Peter's like, no, far be it from you. And Yeshua had to rebuke him, get behind me, Satan. Well, see, you would expect that, because that's the expectation of the people of the Messiah coming in that day. And here he sends them a whopper of a statement. And I want you to listen to this carefully, because this shows how much respect, how much they truly believed he was the Messiah. They don't come back and say anything. They believe in his word. Whatever he speaks, it is the gospel truth. They believe it so much that when they come back, all they can ask is when? When is this going to be? Yeshua answers this as we drop down to verse 15 and we read, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. We learn a lot here. They ask, Yeshua, you're talking about the destruction of the temple, but when is this going to happen? He pinpoints a time. He gives them something to look for that precedes right before the destruction. This is what's going to precede. He gives them a moment in time, what he calls the abomination of desolation. But he doesn't just leave it there, because that could be a little more ambiguous than he wanted to leave. So he gets very specific. The abomination of desolation, not spoken by the prophet Zechariah, not spoken by the prophet Isaiah. No, only specific is Daniel. So he's literally pinpointing. No, what I'm talking about comes out of the book of Daniel. And he takes it a step further with his expectation. He says, whoever reads, let him understand. Not common statement that Yeshua is accustomed to making in the New Testament. As you comb through the Gospels, even through the book of Revelation, what you typically hear is, he who has an ear, let him hear. That's not what is said here. He who reads, this is a very unique statement. In other words, Yeshua is implying what? You're going to go back exactly where I'm taking you, to the book of Daniel, and you are going to read it. You are going to read and study the abomination of desolation and learn what I am talking about, because I am talking about the destruction of the temple, where not one stone will be left upon another. And so we're going to do what Yeshua said to do. We're going to go back to the book of Daniel, and we're going to look for the abomination of desolation. And where we're going to start is in chapter 8. And Daniel's given this vision. And in this vision, we read the following. And as I was considering, suddenly, what happened? A male goat came up from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between its eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. Now, I'm just going to cut to the chase and save some time rather than take you down another rabbit trail. I'm going to explain to you what these are. And I'm not taking a creative liberty here at all. It's an absolute documented biblical fact, what I'm telling you right now. It's included even in this chapter. And that is, the male goat is Greece. It's the kingdom of Greece. We're told this later on in the chapter, so there's no debate on this, all right? So this is the kingdom of Greece. This is a very specific prophecy dealing with specific kingdoms. Very important. So here we have the kingdom of Greece, and down here the ram that has two horns is the kingdom of Medo-Persia or Media-Persia. And it has two horns because these two kingdoms were not getting along, but eventually they joined forces, became one kingdom. And then later on, what you hear about is that one horn is higher than the other. So one side was greater, had greater influence as they joined to one kingdom. But this is the kingdom of Medo-Persia or Media-Persia, all right? So we got that. Now, looking at this right here about the kingdom of Greece, this goat had a notable horn between its eyes. Now, it hones in on this. There's like an emphasis, if you will. There's this notable horn. Who is this? This is what's amazing. Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great is actually in your Bible. I mean, the guy who studied at the feet of Aristotle. He was mentored by Aristotle. This is the guy who, even to this day, people stand in awe of his military campaign. It's considered one of the greatest in the history of the world. The guy he was in command at 18 years old over people, and at 20, he ruled the kingdom. And in 12 years, he ruled the world. Unbelievable. Yes, this is a notable horn, even to this day, secular, you know, you can go talk about secular historians, and they're in awe at Alexander the Great. He's taught to this day. Notable horn, all right? Now we continue on, and we read this. And I saw him confronting the ram. So Alexander the Great and his kingdom of Greece, he's coming to Persia. And he was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Now, just check your history books, because Alexander the Great in 331 BC took out Media-Persia, took down King Darius III. He was totally and utterly destroyed. This was where Alexander comes really to the height of his kingdom. Because guess what? Media-Persia was the superpower. But not anymore. Just as the prophecy said in Daniel, this goat from the west, just look at your map, came across the whole face of the earth. And he fought with the superpower. And they started consuming all of these kingdoms. They just started absorbing all of them. And then we continue on in verse 8. Therefore, the male goat, again, Greece, grew very great. But when he became strong, oh, look at what happens. The large horn was broken. Alexander the Great, just after that battle that I'm talking about, where he took Persia down, defeated King Darius, it was only a year later he died. And there's speculation about what happened. Some say most likely died of a fever of some kind, typhoid or whatever. But he died at a very young age of 32. So he becomes emperor at 20, and in 12 years' time, he's ruling the world, but he dies in the height of his kingdom, which is exactly what it says, okay? When he became strong, the large horn was broken. Now we continue. And in place of it, what? Four notable horns came up toward the four winds of heaven. Here's an interesting fact. And again, this is history. You can check it out. When Alexander died, he did not give his kingdom to one man. He didn't concede it to one man. He actually broke his kingdom, thinking, you know, the thought is he thought it was just too big, it was too much. He broke the kingdom into four kingdoms and gave it to his four generals. And it looks like this. You have Cassander, who took over the region of Macedonia, Greece, Lysimachus, Thrace, Asia Minor, Seleucus, Syria, Mesopotamia, Persia, and Ptolemy, who took over Egypt and Palestine. And Palestine, you should put a question mark there because the Seleucid Empire fought Ptolemy over that, and it wasn't always in Ptolemy's power. One of these I really want you to focus on as we continue, and I want you to remember, is Seleucus. This one is what we need to remember. Continuing on. And out of one of them came a little horn. So out of these four that we just covered, these four generals that he gave his power to, another horn, Another leader is going to rise. This is a little horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, towards the glorious land. So this little horn that's going to rise up out of one of these four generals, okay, he's going to move into the glorious land, to Yerushalayim. He's going to go there. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Understand, prophetically, stars in scripture represent the descendants of Abraham. That's what it represents. It represents the saints of God. So if you're grafted in Israel, you would be considered a star. You know, remember Genesis 15, God brings Abraham outside and he tells Abraham, look up and count the stars if you're able to number them, so shall your descendants be. God himself likened the descendants of Abraham to stars, but it gets better than that. Because when you actually go to the last chapter of Daniel, in Daniel chapter 12, it says, and there will be many who turn people to righteousness. These amazing things, you know what they're called? Stars. These stars with brilliant light, if you will. And so over and over, we know that the descendants of Abraham are stars. This is important because this little horn, he's coming into the glorious land, and he's going to take out some of the people of God. He's going to destroy them. All right? Verse 11. Or let's do this. I put this in a good spot. Antiochus Epiphanes. That little horn we just read about is this guy. He came up from Seleucus. That one, no, those four notable horns, one of them was Seleucus. Here's the little horn that rose to power. Understand this, Antiochus Epiphanes, I can tell you this without reservation, he is one of the most overt, most comprehensive figures of Antichrist you will ever learn or read about anywhere in the history of the world. The guy is the embodiment of the Antichrist. And we'll probably even talk about this as we press in, get into Hanukkah later this year. We'll circle back on this. But this guy is the essence of pure evil. And you can see what he thought of himself. This name, Epiphanes, which he gave himself, means God manifest. Okay? So this is what he thought of himself. Now going on to verse 11. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. No kidding. He thinks he's God. Okay, he's high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Okay, and here's what happens. And in 167 BC, things really ramped up with Antiochus and the Seleucid army coming into the glorious land, coming into Jerusalem, and wreaking havoc on the Jewish people. And Antiochus went in absolutely defiled. He defiled the altar of God, putting up a forbidden image, a pagan image, totally defiled. And he himself was so arrogant that he went into the Holy of Holies. He went into the holy place, the temple that only the high priest is allowed to go in. And you think of the high priest is only allowed to go in the Holy of Holies once a year. Antiochus rolls in as though he is God. And he starts putting his defiled hands, uncircumcised Gentile, defiled hands on the holy artifacts, which aren't even allowed to be seen by the general public of Israel. Not even allowed to be seen. And this is what he does. Now, moving on to verse 12. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn, meaning Antiochus, to oppose the daily sacrifices. So now we're told, why did this guy get this power to overcome God's people? Because of sin. This is why. So to oppose the daily sacrifices, oh, and what did he do? He cast truth to the ground. He did all this and prospered. You know, the amazing thing is about Antiochus is he actually decreed a law. It was an edict of the king. If you were caught, not even reading, if you were caught possessing a copy of the Torah, a copy of the prophets, you were to be put to death immediately. So this kind of, it's interesting, when I was talking about in the revival of the spirit of Antichrist and communism, it is the spirit of Antichrist because I've seen it before. I know what it does. It comes after this. You cannot possess this when the spirit of Antichrist is running loose. It will come for it. It will try to take it from you. It knows what it means to your life. And you better pay attention to what's going on in this country right now, because there is a move. There is a move. And I'm talking in the halls of Congress where this thing's on schedule. They want to literally ban this book. It is coming. And we're already seeing evidence in certain states like California, where even parts of it were being forbidden to counsel people with the words of the Lord. It's being forbidden. They want to actually make it illegal. They want to pass laws to do this. Understand, the spirit of Antichrist is in the halls of Congress in this nation. It is in our schools. It is in our media. It is everywhere. It is literally sweeping this land. And I'm going to tell you, as you start to look at the abomination of desolation, we're going to learn more than what I'm even after. We're going to learn the reality of the Antichrist. I mean, this is what's going on. So he cast truth to the ground. He forbid the Jews to observe Shabbat, forbid them to keep the festivals of God. I mean, absolute insanity. Verse 13, then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who is speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices? Oh, and the transgression of desolation, hapesha shemem. I mean, this is the abomination of desolation. This is the first time we see this word used in the book of Daniel, or this term. It is clear. There's no question what we're talking about here. We are talking about an abomination of desolation. All right? And this is a very specific prophecy again. I can't emphasize this enough. Specific kings coming out of specific kingdoms in a specific manner at a specific time. I mean, this is all calculated. And now he actually gets into the time. So he literally says, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices, the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled upon underfoot? How long is this going to happen? There's an answer. And he said to me, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Now, the first thing that you need to know about this prophecy is this prophecy was fulfilled in the second century BC with deadly accuracy. Every fragment of what we just read was fulfilled to the T. Every bit of it. Even to the point of, after the specific time, the sanctuary would be cleansed. The altar was cleansed. In fact, the altar was rededicated on 167, 25th of Kislev, 167 BC. The altar was defiled on that very same day, the 25th of Kislev, and 164 BC, the altar was rededicated. And now we have an actual celebration. It's called Hanukkah. We have this story, the fulfillment of this prophecy recorded in the Apocrypha, recorded in the books known as the Maccabees, which Martin Luther himself says has weight with the faithful, but it avails nothing among the obstinate. If you want to feel the weight of how much weight Martin Luther put on the Apocrypha, specifically the Maccabees, it was heavy for him. He had it, he read it, he studied it. It avails much with the faithful. We have this today, and see, where I'm going with this is this. In Yeshua's day, as he's talking about the abomination of desolation, and keep in mind, Yeshua himself kept Hanukkah. Go to the Gospel of John, read John chapter 10, verse 22. Yeshua went up and celebrated Hanukkah. There's no mystery. When Yeshua starts talking about the abomination of desolation, the disciples know exactly where Yeshua is coming from, what Hanukkah is. They know what Hanukkah is, and they understand that. But I have a question. When Yeshua spoke the words he spoke, specific words he spoke, my question to you is this. Did the disciples think what Yeshua was talking about, the prophecy we just read? Did they think that? Even when they went back to, because this is the question, this is important. And I'm going to tell you, that's impossible. And you might say, well, how so? And this merits a little discussion. Yeshua described that the temple, not one stone will be left upon another. And Yeshua doesn't just describe that. Do you know that he actually describes that Jerusalem will be entirely destroyed? There'll be nothing left to it? Nothing. We're talking two things. Listen carefully. Jerusalem, the entire city, is to be eviscerated. The temple is to be eviscerated. No evidence that all the stones are gone, broken down. Now I ask you, in this prophecy we just read, is this the case? You can't do that because all they did was cleanse the temple. Antiochus Epiphanes never went in and destroyed Jerusalem. He defiled it with the blood of Jews, killing these Jews and casting down the truth and going forth and doing this. There's no question about that. No, all of Judea attempting to do this. That's total desecration. There's no question about it. He did not destroy the temple. He did not destroy Jerusalem. So it's important that we cover this because what Yeshua is describing is totally different. Yes, I could say they're both abominations of desolation, but what Yeshua is describing goes way beyond this. My next question is this. Is there anywhere else in the book of Daniel that would fit exactly what Yeshua is describing? And I'm going to tell you there is, and we don't have to go very far. We only need to go to the next chapter. In Daniel chapter 9, we're going to start at verse 24. The angel Gabriel comes to Daniel to deliver this supernatural revelation to him. And this is what we read. 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Now, if you're Daniel, who is sitting in this situation, and you're in the captivity, okay? Babylon came in, destroyed the temple. Daniel's in the captivity, and here the angel Gabriel comes and gives him what you would call the best news anyone could ever receive. This is, in fact, Daniel being a Jew, this in their history, nothing greater has been heard of. Nothing greater for someone to come. Something's going to happen where someone comes, he's going to put an end to transgression. He's going to end sin. He's going to bring in everlasting righteousness, and he will anoint the most holy. This is an amazing time. And so Daniel's hearing these words. And we look at this prophecy, who are we talking about? We're talking about Yeshua. Yeshua's on the cross in John 19:30, and he says three words that come right back here. It is finished. What was finished? This, exactly what it says, to finish the transgression. Yeshua ended it. He ended transgression through his sacrifice. And so this prophecy, you know, we were talking about how specific the prophecy in Daniel 8 is. Very specific. Specific players, specific kingdoms, specifically how they come out of other leaders. This prophecy is equally specific. It is so specific, especially in regard to time. Now look at this. In Daniel 9:25, know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Mashiach the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, the street shall be built again, and the wall even in troublesome times. This is amazing. 70 weeks are determined for your people. Now listen to this. 70 weeks are determined for you and your people. Then what we have is 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So we have 69 weeks together. And there's a lot of debate of why were the 69 weeks broken up? Why was it broken up into 7 weeks first and then to 62 weeks? But what you need to understand, I'm going to simplify this, is you have 69 weeks and then you have the coming of the Messiah. He comes at the end of the 69 weeks. Now look at this, and we read this as we continue. And after the 62 weeks, which comes after the 7 weeks, okay? So we're at the end of all this counting of almost at the very end of the 70 weeks. The Mashiach shall be cut off, but not for himself, because the Messiah did not sin to merit death. He died for us so that we could be forgiven. And the people of the prince who is to come, oh, look at this. shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Till the end of the war, desolations are determined. This prophecy is very specific. It specifically states that no, Jerusalem is to be totally destroyed. And guess what? So is the temple. Now you go back to Yeshua's words, he made it very clear, not one stone will be left upon another in regard to the temple. But in Luke 21, the very same thing, he says this, we get more information with Luke. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then you know its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So here we are with Yeshua. I mean, this prophecy that we are reading fits perfectly with the words that Yeshua spoke. What happened with Antiochus Epiphanes, that was fulfilled. But not this, not Daniel 9. This hadn't been fulfilled when Yeshua was speaking to them. Okay, verse 27, we continue. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, okay, so now we're at the last week. Remember, Yeshua came at the end of the 69 weeks. But then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abominations shall be the one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. Here you have clearly the abomination of desolation. Now, here's what's interesting. Isn't this interesting? We have the 70 weeks, but at the very end, almost at the 70 weeks, we have the coming of the Messiah. And after he dies, it's just a short time. It's a short time before this prophecy comes to pass where Jerusalem is destroyed, the temple is destroyed. Now, we know Yeshua came, and it's estimated that he died around 30 AD. Do we know of any event that would come shortly or thereafter that would fit this perfectly? And yes, we do. In 70 AD, shortly after his death, Rome comes in under the authority of Titus, ultimately under Vespasian, his father, who was emperor of Rome. He comes in and he literally levels. He levels the temple. It is absolutely atrocious what Rome did. It was so horrible. I want to take you to the writings of Josephus, because we actually have an eyewitness account on what took place here. He's a first century Jewish historian, Roman Jewish historian. And I want you to feel the weight of what took place. And this is what we read. The Romans, though it was a terrible struggle to collect the timber, raised their platforms in 21 days. So they're building a siege against Jerusalem. Having, as described before, stripped the whole area in a circle round the town to a distance of 10 miles, the countryside, like the city, was a pitiful sight. For where once there had been a lovely vista of woods and parks, there was nothing but desert and stumps of trees. No one, not even a foreigner, who had seen the old Judea and the glorious suburbs of the city, and now set eyes on her present desolation, could have helped sighing and groaning at so terrible a change. For every trace of beauty had been blotted out by war. And nobody who had known it in the past and came upon it suddenly would have recognized the place. When he was already there, he would still have been looking for the city. In other words, what Josephus is saying is Rome did such a good job at absolutely destroying Jerusalem. If you had been there, even if you had lived there, you'd come, you would never know where it is. You wouldn't even have a clue that you're there. Now that is desolation. In fact, Josephus, he goes on to make this statement. Listen to this. And indeed it came to pass that our nation suffered these things under Antiochus Epiphanes, according to Daniel's vision and what he wrote many years before they came to pass. In the very same manner, Daniel also wrote concerning the Roman government and that our country should be made desolate by them. That is amazing. Josephus even acknowledges, hey, Daniel prophesied, chapter 8, he prophesied about the coming of Antiochus Epiphanes, and it was fulfilled years before, just as Daniel prophesied. I mean, with deadly accuracy. But he also spoke of Rome. He also spoke of another government that would come and would totally desolate us. And it's interesting, actually, scripture, if you go back to Daniel 7, It does talk about Rome, the fourth beast that arises to power. This is the book of Daniel. Scary, you know, liberal scholars today, and not surprising, liberal scholars today are so thwarted by the deadly accuracy of Daniel's prophecies because they are so specific that they are attempting, these liberal scholars are attempting to write it off. Well, it had to be written after these things happened. This could not have been written before. There's no way. And then they try to tear the book of Daniel apart in different ways. It is just demonic. Daniel prophesied about these things long before with precision. And God brought this about with precision, exactly how he prophesied. When God gets that specific in prophecies, you better believe he's going to carry it out. And he did. Twice. Very, very important. Now, continuing on, we read this. Josephus says, "Now the number of those that were carried captive during this whole war was collected to be 97,000, as was the number of those that perished during the whole siege, 1,100,000. In other words, he just said, in Jerusalem, the Romans came in and over 1.1 million Jews died. And almost 100,000 were taken captive. And that doesn't include the ones that got out. The ones that understood the words of Yeshua and his warning. When you see this standing in the holy place, when you see this coming, the abomination, get out, flee, get out of Judea. Yeshua warned this. And there were many people that didn't understand his words, or shall I say, didn't believe them. They didn't believe his words. Now, continuing on, we read this. The greater part of whom were indeed of the same nation, meaning Jews, with the citizens of Jerusalem, but not belonging to the city itself, for they had come up from all the country to the feast of unleavened bread and were on a sudden shut up by an army. No wonder we see the number of casualties, because that number is so ridiculously excessive. You would not have 1 million people in this day living in Jerusalem, but they were there during the feast of Passover. This is when this happened. Which, at the very first, occasioned so great a straitness among them that there came a pestilential destruction upon them, and soon afterwards such a famine as destroyed them more suddenly. Now, this vast multitude is indeed collected out of remote places, but the entire nation was now shut up by fate as in a prison, and the Roman army, listen to this, the Roman army encompassed the city when it was crowded with inhabitants. This is Josephus, an eyewitness account says, Rome totally surrounded it. What did Yeshua say? But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. Exactly what Yeshua warned in regard to the abomination of desolation. He said, then know its desolation is near. I'm going to tell you this. You look at Jerusalem today, the status has not changed. The Temple Mount is desolate. It's completely desolate. Look at it. This is not a Jewish temple. This is not a Jewish temple. This is an Islamic temple. This is the Dome of the Rock, technically. And I've been there. This is a picture I took while I was on there. And I know I've shared this, and I'm going to share it again. You can't prepare yourself for Israel, so don't bother. Because whatever you think you're going to feel and do or whatever, God's got a different plan, and the Holy Spirit does something totally different. You're going to get there, and you're going to be overwhelmed. I didn't know what to expect. I was excited because I heard, oh, everyone goes up to the Temple Mount and they love to pray. You know, you're not dropping to your knees. You have the Islamic waqf there. They're going to make sure you don't pray. And so they guard and they have people hiding behind trees, not even making this up. And you walk. I'm going to tell you my experience, and everyone has a different experience. When I went there, and this is no joke, I started walking and my guide was with me, but he went off and he was quite a distance away. And I just kind of lost myself. And I started walking towards the Dome of the Rock. And I have never felt such darkness in my life. There was maybe one other time I can attest to feel that kind of darkness, that kind of emptiness. You know what word came to my mind, which again, not thinking anything over and over, desolation. Desolation. I just, all I could think about is this desolation. It was so horrific. And one thing I can tell you, I mean, again, you can't pre-plan these things, but walking to this, it's like I felt the weight of millions of Muslims and a burden for their salvation, of wanting them to know the truth, of wanting them to save. I want them to experience true love. True love, the love of Yeshua. You feel this and you feel such darkness and there's such, you can feel the blindness. It's pure wickedness. But here's the thing. You know, when I talk about desolation, do you know what the walls inside of this are inscribed with? I want to share with you some of the things that are inscribed with, that are in this wall. This is the Temple Mount. This is where the Holy of Holies stood. Let me share this with you. O people of the book, now this is inside the Dome of the Rock, do not exaggerate in your religion, nor utter aught concerning God except or save the truth. The Messiah Jesus, who knew? Jesus is mentioned in the Dome of the Rock. And the Messiah Jesus, son of Mary, was only a messenger of God. And his word, which he conveyed unto Mary and his spirit from him, so believe in God and his messengers and say not three, cease. You're not allowed to speak Father, Son, Holy Spirit. But the real one you need to, you know, to focus on here, that Jesus is only a messenger. Do you understand? This is on the Temple Mount. This is inscribed in these walls. We go on. It befitteth not the majesty of God that he should take unto himself a son. See, in Islam, and this is the way you define Allah, this is the way you define, one of the ways you define him, he has no son. That is the opposite of Judeo-Christianity. The only way that we can know God, that we can have God, that we can have the Father is if we have the Son. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. You want to talk about opposite ends of the spectrum here, but this has been written in the Dome of the Rock. This is what's being declared on the holiest place on planet Earth. There's no other way to define this. It's called blasphemy. You know, to a Muslim, if you say God has a son, you are blaspheming their God. And what's interesting is they're on this side and they say, well, God has no son. Well, wait a second. That's blasphemy of God for the Judeo-Christians. It is blasphemy to not testify to the truth of who Yeshua is. Blasphemy. We read this, far be it removed from his transcendent majesty that he should have a son. This is filling the walls of what's inscribed here. It's all about the son. Isn't that amazing? I'm going to tell you this, this entire book is all about the son. Everything. This world was created through the son. We were redeemed through the son, and the world is going to be judged through the son. We read, praise be to God who hath not taken unto himself a son and who hath no partner in the sovereignty. You know, one of the things that baffles me, and I know you get this, there are some Christians waiting for the abomination of desolation. And I'm like, really? This is as desolate as, like, what do you want? This is as desolate, this is the abomination of desolation. Look at it. And even to this day, there are Orthodox weeping that they cannot go up to the Temple Mount, that there is no, they're weeping. They know this is wrong. Something's out of place here. You go, have you been to the Christian Quarter? How many of you have been to the Christian Quarter? Raise your hand. Okay, that's sad. You go to the Christian Quarter in the old city of Jerusalem. It is absolutely filled with idols. Things that are absolutely abominable. You know, today we can talk about how you know, Antiochus Epiphanes, when he went back and he set up these images, and even horrible Israel kings setting up images. The city is filled with abominable idols of the Mother Mary, co-mediatrix, co-redeemer. You cannot possibly for a second not walk into Jerusalem and not say desolation. It's utterly indecent. When gay parades are coming into the holy city of Jerusalem and marching under the protection of the Shoarim and IDF, what do you call that? I mean, what else would you call that? And I make this statement because I don't think we know how close we are to Yeshua coming back, to we're at the very end of the age. Let me tie this in with how I began. We talked about the foxes and that symbol. Listen to this statement in Lamentations. We read this: "The crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us, for we have sinned. Because of this, our heart is faint. Because of these things, our eyes grow dim. Because of Mount Zion, which is desolate with foxes walking about it." You want to talk about biblical prophecy? Listen to the prophets. The prophets are crying out. They're trying to tell you something. Like, can we not? Are we hypocrites? Can we not discern the signs of the times? This is scary. I mean, you look, and that's why I say end of the world prophecy of foxes up on the Temple Mount. This is end of the world stuff. And what did Yeshua say? I love this. "See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." This is the prophecy of the Messiah. And of course, I want to end on a good note. The reality is this: it will remain desolate until the Jewish people, until they call on the Son of God, until they call on Yeshua. And guess what he's going to do? He will deliver all Israel. He will destroy their enemies, and there will be peace, and there will be shalom. The victory is certain. Yeshua can't lose. That's the truth. I want to close with Zechariah because we need to start looking to this prophecy. I can't talk about this enough. Zechariah 14, "Behold, the day of the Lord is coming." Yeshua is coming. "And your spoil will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken. The house is rifled. The women ravished. Half the city will go into captivity. But the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle." Now look at what happens. This is a prophecy of Zechariah. Yeah, there's a time of Jacob's trouble. And guess what happens to the holy city of Jerusalem? It is divided in two. The UN is proposing, and there is even presidential candidates proposing right now, the answer is a two-state solution. To divide Jerusalem into two. This is prophecy. And I'm telling you, when you see this, you're going to see Jacob's trouble erupt. But the good thing is the Jewish people are going to turn back to the Messiah at that point because they're not going to be able to defend themselves. The UN will gather all the nations to battle against her. And that's the time when they cry in Yeshua, there's going to be supernatural intervention. This is where we need to be at. This is what we need to be focused. We need to have our eyes open, our ears open. And I'm going to tell you, and I can't say this enough, you cannot play with your faith anymore. You have to get as serious as you possibly can humanly get. Every fragment of your heart has to be filled with Yeshua, has to be filled with his word. You have to spend more time in prayer. You have to learn how to fast. I'm telling you, we need to turn with fasting and weeping and mourning. There's nothing, I mean, the Spirit did this before even getting into these passages. It was the Spirit driving me to fasting. Before I started teaching on it, something's going on is what I'm telling you. This is crazy. We need to be fasting and praying because what is coming, you will not survive. You will fail. You will compromise. Some of you are already compromising and the wood is green. Some of you have already given your heart to the world and you're not living sold out radical lives for Yeshua. You're not going to make it. It's time to get real in the faith. We are at the end. It doesn't get more serious than this.